Amen. What verbs can we attach to sin? Sin what? We could say sin distorts. We could say sin corrupts. Sin deceives. Sin entangles. All of these things are relevant verbs taught in various parts of the Old and New Testaments. The list could actually get quite long. There's a kind of havoc that sin wreaks upon us. Sin defiles. That verb is key to tonight's passage. Sin defiles, it spoils, it ruins. It takes what is unspoiled and it desecrates it. It creates a profaned situation. That is what sin does. Sin is anti-God, sin is anti-neighbor, sin is anti-human. Sin defiles. We're going to see that that is one of the aspects of sin's effects in tonight's passage. We're in part of a section of Deuteronomy that really extends through about Deuteronomy 26, where we're going to start seeing in these several chapters a series of laws. Some of them are head-scratching. You might read through a part of Deuteronomy in these next several chapters and you think, what is going on here? And then you might come to a part of the chapters to come where one particular instruction could seem so disturbing or surprising. And you think, how should I think about this? And as a Christian, you know, what's the best way to understand this all these years later? Deuteronomy 21 has a few of these laws. And the passage tonight, not knowing even weeks ago where I would want to divide this into this chapter or if we'd want to do the whole thing, we're only looking at 9 verses tonight. It's a circumstance, a situation of a slain man and the unknown perpetrator and a ritual that is done in order to deal with one of the effects of sin. And it's not something that could be measured with some sort of scientific instrument where somebody could say, oh, there's the defilement. Instead, it's a spiritual statement. It's to mean that something horrible and rebellious has taken place and God's moral law has been violated, and that to violate the will of God and to discard the commands of God is to bring about a defiled state. This is a spiritual statement. Sin defiles. The passage tonight in these first 9 verses that will comprise our sermon text is connected thematically with an earlier part of chapter 19. In chapter 19, there was a great concern about those who committed manslaughter, who did not intentionally take the life of someone, and they had a city of refuge for them to flee to while all the matter was getting judicially worked out. This was to preserve their life in case an avenger of blood decided to act quickly and hastily, prevailing upon them and assuming some kind of homicide or premeditated murder had taken place. But chapter 19's theme that goes over into this is the idea of someone who has died. In chapter 21, this is not the result of an unintended act. It says in chapter 21, verse 1, that a man is found slain. This is not a natural death. We're dealing with a homicide, and we're dealing with a situation where a perpetrator has not been caught. Now, you know that this is not an old problem only. I mean, we recognize that even in the city of Louisville, we can hear of stories throughout the week where a particular case is being investigated, a slain person has been discovered, and some sort of evidence is being pursued, and an extraordinary percentage of crimes, murders, are never solved. And we deal with an old situation in Israel. How are they to think about this when these people involved in this ritual, they didn't do it? The act of murder, that is. And yet, though they did not commit the sin which violated the sixth commandment, they do recognize that rebellion against God in their midst isn't without effect. It has brought some sort of defilement that they want to recognize and to symbolically counter with their obedience and their resolve before God. So here you have a neighbor within the community of Israel, and the body has been found, he has been slain. This part of Deuteronomy that we've been dealing with has an undergirding commandment that seems to be shaping these laws. Even though this is a hypothetical scenario, It's grounded in the sixth commandment. You shall not murder. And just like chapter 19 dealt with that, chapter 20 deals with the preservation of life as well, especially with laws regarding warfare and how to handle those matters. Chapter 21 continues the notion of image bearers and how life is to be treated. The ritual that follows may seem strange. Get a heifer, go to a place where there's running water, make sure the heifer has never done any work, and break its neck. How should we connect that ritual to what's happening here? So we're going to try to do that. But aside from the ceremonial aspect of it, it is not okay that a death happened. A murder took place, and nobody's to look at that situation and say, well, what's the big deal there? No, it is a big deal because an image bearer's life was taken. A slain person has been discovered. And in verse 1, this is envisioning their promised land occupation. If in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. So this is the promised land they're looking toward, right? If someone is found slain. Now, found by whom? Well, it doesn't say, but we can imagine that somebody traveling to or from the area has in the open country come across this body. The person is found slain. The word could be translated pierced. Pierced. So no one would look at this and say, natural death? No, that is not what's happened here. You have a slain person in this open country, and the sadness is we do not know who's responsible. That's one of the most grievous things in a fallen world, because Deuteronomy is concerned with the cause of justice. Deuteronomy wants those who violate the law of God, and especially in a sense where there is criminal behavior against neighbor, that those things not be ignored or swept under the rug, but that wrongdoers face reasonable and just penalties for their crimes. Here you have a situation where it is not known who killed him. Just imagine the agony. You know, this person, somebody's father maybe, husband maybe, son maybe, neighbor maybe, community member of Israel nevertheless. Here you have someone in the open country slain, and it is not known, and that's going to affect others. Those lives are going to be impacted. And in verse 2, there are some measures that are going to be taken. You're going to get your elders and your judges to come out. Now, these groups, the elders, would be those who are recognizably, either by their reputation and by their age, to be considered more wise among the Israelite camp, more trustworthy, more responsible to deal with particular spiritual matters that arise. These elders, along with the judges would engage in judicial proceedings. So they've got a legal interest in seeing justice done. You have both elders and judges who are coming out to the situation. You can imagine then you have some sort of inquiry. Does anybody know what's happened? And here it is not known who has committed the violation of the sixth commandment. Now, who's going to enact this particular ritual? Because the land has received innocent blood. This seems to be something going all the way back to Cain's murder of Abel. Now, it doesn't reference Cain and Abel here, but I just want to try to tie this conceptually. The ground has received innocent blood. And when the Lord confronts Cain about Cain's heinous act, in Genesis chapter 4, the language is that your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Cain's action was unjust. Cain's action was wicked. Cain's action was murderous. Abel's blood was poured out and Abel was innocent. Not that Abel is without sin, but Abel died unlawfully. Abel died out of the anger and murderous rage of his brother who lured him into a field, let's say the open country, like where this person in Deuteronomy 21 is found. So this person is lying in the open country, and his innocent blood has filled the ground. And that creates a spiritual situation, a kind of defilement. You know, just imagine, you're doing something in the kitchen, and you've got some colored thing in a glass. Maybe it's something you're mixing together, something in a bowl, and you just knock it off the counter. You didn't mean to, but it just goes everywhere. You can tell what's happened, because whatever you've been mixing together is layered. The color is visible. The thickness of it is there. You've got to deal with this. Imagine that physical illustration forming an analogy to the spiritual thing. It's like some kind of spiritual defilement has happened into the land. even if these people did not take it upon themselves to commit the act, they have to deal with the result. And these elders and these judges are going to come out and they're going to measure the distance to the surrounding cities. You got cities throughout the Promised Land. Who's going to enact this ritual? Not every city. It's not like, you know, they go out to find the morning paper that on this day and on this time, all the cities in the land are going to do this particular heifer ritual. One group of people is going to do it. How do you know which one? Well, you're going to quite literally do some measuring. You're going to do maybe educated guessing as best as you can to determine what city is the closest to the slain man. And whichever city is closest to the slain man, they're going to take on some responsibility. And you say, well, wait a second, though. They didn't commit this act. They didn't commit the act. And so the Lord isn't holding them culpable, but it is a recognition that defilement has taken place and innocent blood has poured into the ground. And that's not nothing. That's significant. And to reckon with that reality that the law of God was breached and that something heinous has taken place, a symbolic ritual is going to follow. And the city that's going to do it is the city closest to the slain man. They figure that out by measuring from the slain man to the nearest city. And then we're told in verse 3, the elders of the city that is nearest to the slain man shall take a heifer that has never been worked. So we're thinking about the domestic life of people in the ancient world using animals to work their property. But there would be animals young enough that would not be called upon to put the yoke on and to work on the ground and to do that hard labor. It's this kind of animal that's in view. One that, according to verse 3, has never been worked and has not pulled in a yoke. And then you're going to take this heifer, which seems to be on, we would say, on the younger side, the more vulnerable side, the inexperienced side. And in verse 4, they're to bring this heifer down to a valley. We immediately notice this is not taking place in the same vicinity as where the slain man was. The change in location is also symbolic. Not just what they're going to do with the heifer, but where it's taking place. They're going to take the heifer down to a valley with running water. So all these details, you know, they're not arbitrary. So there's running water in this valley, and in this area, it's neither been plowed nor sown. Now, you can imagine land where you would have a stream nearby thinking, okay, here's a good place. We're going to plant some stuff. We're going to grow some things. And in this location, it must be in a valley where you've not done that. You've got running water, and you haven't been taking it upon yourself or nor others have to plant and to sow and harvest. And in that valley, and without running water, and with this unworked heifer, you're to break its neck. Let's think about this ritual for a moment. The whole set of details together seem to communicate, or at least give the impression of freshness and newness. Does that resonate with you? If you look at the language here, the heifer's never worked, never pulled in a yoke. What about this valley? No one has sown anything there. No one's planted anything there. There's running water there. There seems to be something vibrant, something fresh, something unspoiled. Something unspoiled. And this is meant to symbolize something. Now, as we think about this ritual, I just want to zoom out to say when the Passover requires an unblemished young lamb, those particular details also matter, right? That this is an unblemished lamb. It's something without defect. And when the Passover is enacted for the first time in the book of Exodus, you see those stipulations carrying over year by year for the feasts. These details, then he doesn't just say, bring whatever animal and just, you know, break its neck. Instead, in verse 4, the heifer is unworked. The running water is not beside anything that's planted or grown. It's all very fresh, all very unused. And then the heifer's neck is broken. This is not quite like a sacrificial ritual. That's the first thing to notice here in addition to these details. Why would I say this is not quite like a sacrificial ritual? Because it says the elders shall break the heifer's neck. Who's involved in the sacrificial procedure when other animals are offered for proper sacrifices? Well, it's the priests. The Levitical priests. That's not these people here in verse 4. And it doesn't say, make sure you take the heifer to the tabernacle, to the bronze altar. There is no altar mentioned here. There is no tabernacle mentioned. Instead, you're to go to a valley with some running water. No doubt the most accessible valley from wherever the city that is closest to the slain man can take the heifer and the group. So the elders are taking the heifer down, and we know immediately this is not what we're used to reading when it comes to an animal being given in some way. We're used to seeing priests invoked. We're used to seeing some sort of ceremonial ritual at the tabernacle where it might say something like, and they appeared before the Lord, which is referencing to that sanctuary, referencing the sanctuary. That's not what this says. This is different. So I don't want us to think of this as a kind of formal sacrifice in the way we're used to seeing animals offered. This is different. But the animal's neck is broken in the valley, and there's been some serious consideration among Old Testament scholars as to how to think about this ritual. And it seems like two main views rise to the surface. Okay? Two main views. First is that the ritual represents the execution of the murderer. Okay? So murderer is unknown, and so something is executed in this valley with running water, unused ground, unworked heifer. So maybe it symbolizes the execution of the murderer. The other most viable option, I think, these two options, were one that is the execution of the murderer symbolized. The other is it's a reenactment of the murder of the innocent man. And so there are Old Testament scholars who have one leaning this way and others that you would read who have a leaning the other way. Is this the execution of the murderer that is symbolized, or is this the murder of the innocent person reenacted? I think there are good arguments for both views. My leaning is that it represents the execution of the murderer. But this is a tricky ceremony because it doesn't fully explain the reasoning or an interpretation of the elements, right? So we're noticing that the ceremony is described, and then there's this testimony that's given, our hands didn't shed this blood, and yet at the same time, we're not told what exactly the whole thing is to represent symbolically. And so the best efforts of Old Testament scholars seem to come down to these two views. Does this symbolize the murderer being executed, or does this symbolize the murder of the innocent person being reenacted? Let's think about this second view for a moment. The symbolism of the murder of the innocent person. The reason some might look to this is because the heifer is unworked and the ground is unplowed and unsown. And it has, let's just say figuratively speaking, the kind of aroma of innocence to the whole scene. Okay? This isn't a heifer that has worn the yoke and a ground that has been used. There seems to be something fresh and unused and, let's say, innocent about the whole scene. And then this unworked heifer is put to death. And so some would say maybe that's the point here. It's a reenactment of the murder. Now, there's not another ritual or ceremony like this in any parallel to this law or this scenario. I don't favor this view, even though I think it is interesting to consider the freshness and innocence, if you could call it that, figuratively speaking, of this heifer. Instead, I think it's more likely that the execution of the murderer is being symbolized. I want to note first that in verse 1, it says that the man has been slain and it's not known who killed him. What would be the responsibility of the community if someone had been known that had committed this murder? Well, according to the law of Moses, the murderer is to be put to death. So what's interesting is they don't know who killed the man that they might put him to death. And in the ceremony, something else is put to death. So that's interesting to me, first of all. But then secondly, consider the language in verse 6. We're just going to peek ahead, or in verse 7, and we're going to peek ahead, where they say, our hands didn't shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. Now, whose blood there? Are they slaughtering this heifer? What's the actual means of death? Breaking the heifer's neck. And breaking the heifer's neck is a heifer that is put to death without the spilling of blood. That's not, you know, a spilling of blood that's emphasized in this scene. This is, by all accounts, a bloodless death of this animal. So when they say, Our hands didn't shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. What they're referring to is not the heifer, but the man's death, the slain man, whose blood they did not shed, nor their eyes did they see who did it. And so they're bearing a testimony about their innocence in the whole matter. And so I think their innocence and the innocence of the heifer might be something that's interestingly correlated, but this man is not found who has killed the slain person. And yet something is executed in its place. And they say, don't set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people, Israel. I think we could imagine this heifer in some way having counted to it blood guilt that ought to have been upon the murderer dealt with by the community. So you've got the community that would deal with this murderer by capital punishment. Not knowing who that is, the heifer's neck is broken, and they say, Lord, accept atonement in verse 8. Don't set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people. What's connected there is the death of the heifer and the words that they're saying. It's as if this offering of this animal, though not at a tabernacle and not executed by the priests, is an animal offered to in some way absorb the defilement. Okay, so I'm trying to choose my language carefully here because I know it sounds strange. It's like, what are they taking a sponge to something that is spilled and they're just kind of absorbing it up? Think of offering an animal in some way in a place of another, or in this case, in the place of the murderer. The murderer ought to be put to death, and the heifer is put to death in some way to remove the defilement that looms over the people. It's as if this sacrifice, this innocent, unworked animal in this flowing water valley with unsown, unplanted ground, absorbs the defilement. So I think of the two options, the least likely is that this is a reenactment of the murder, and more likely it is to symbolize the execution of the murderer who currently is unknown and yet has brought defilement morally upon the people, upon the land, and they have this communal responsibility to address this defilement. But just to press again this point, I'm not trying to show that this is an actual sacrifice by the priests. That's not that. Something other than that. So in verse 4, they break the heifer's neck in the valley, but we know the priests are there. It tells us that in verse 5. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come forward. Which means they're not involved in the breaking of the heifer's neck. The elders broke the heifer's neck in the valley, and then the priests are coming forward. And it tells us they're there, but it doesn't exactly say what they do. This is mystified people. Because it doesn't tell us what the heifer symbolizes. We've got to kind of reason that out. And I think the most likely is it symbolizes the execution of the murderer. But in verse 5, these priests, they're named as present. It doesn't tell us what they do on this scene. It just tells us what God has used them for. They shall come forward because the Lord has chosen them to minister to him, to bless in the name of the Lord, and by their word every dispute and every assault shall be settled. The priests have some kind of formal confirming and assuring role in matters of ceremonial activity, some kind of ritual. It's as if the presence of the priests is to stand in approval of what has just taken place, even if they're not the ones that broke the heifer's neck. The priests are there and they shall come forward. They seem to be physically demonstrating the confirmation and the approval of what has taken place. And then back to the elders. Like, we don't get anything else from the priests. It just mentions them. Back to the elders in verse 6. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. All right, well, now we're starting to see why running water is important. The running water in the scene is part of what will be involved in the washing of the hands. All of this is symbolic. The heifer and the neck breaking is not some sort of magical thing, nothing like that. This is a ceremonial, a symbolic act. And what it demonstrates in verse 6 with the washing of their hands is that they are innocent of this sin. They are nearest to the slain man. They wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they testify, our hands didn't shed this blood. What blood? The blood of the heifer? No, they didn't slaughter the heifer. The neck is broken. The blood that was shed and their eyes not seeing the blood shed was the death of the slain man. It wouldn't make sense if this was the heifer. Because in verse 7, it says, our eyes didn't see it shed. Well, if they put the heifer to death through shedding its blood, they most certainly saw it shed. They're not talking about the heifer here. They're talking about the slain man's death. And they're saying they were innocent of what takes place. Our hands didn't shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. They are innocent. And in verse 8, they say in this testimony, accept atonement, O Lord. That's a strong plea. Accept atonement. Something is disjointed in the community when community members are sinning against others. And here the sixth commandment has been violated. The image bearer's life has been taken. And they know that this sin needs to be covered. And that's what atonement means. They need the Lord not to bring judgment on defilement. They're innocent of it. The whole ritual is to symbolize their innocence and likely the execution symbolized the execution of the heifer, symbolizing the execution of the criminal. Accept atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. You say, well, okay, if the murderer is the one who broke the sixth commandment, and he would be the one guilty, what are they concerned about? That this man has brought defilement into their midst through his rebellion, and they don't know who he is to bring an accounting to his actions. So you have sin unaccounted. You have defilement unaddressed. And so they know that this needs to be covered. Something about this ritual has an absorbing or substitutionary, I'm just going to push that word forward, feature here in the text. You've redeemed your people, so don't set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst so that blood guilt be atoned for. Now, the principle that seems to be at work here is something innocent taking the place of the one who is guilty. You see that principle, don't you? Especially if we don't adopt the view of this being a reenactment of the murder. If this is the execution of the murderer that ought to have happened by the community following the law of Moses, well, they don't know who this murderer is. And so here you have this heifer. It's like, what did this heifer do? But you see, that's part of the point. That's actually part of the principle at work here, is that this heifer isn't guilty. You have a principle at work with these various animals in the rituals of the Israelites. And it is a principle of what is innocent taking the place of what is guilty. And you can see where this is going. Because stories like this and ceremonies like this, and we're not performing this ceremony. I mean, when's the last time we've had to do anything to a heifer as a church? Okay, it's probably been a long time. Instead, what you recognize is the Israelite community is engaged in something in the old covenant shadows and ceremonies, which are forward pointing. Amen. In verse 9, so you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst. When you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. The language of what you do, what is right, refers to their ceremony that they're to enact. That's the thing that they would be right to do. And so when you do that, you are purging the guilt of innocent blood. Sin not only defiles, sin brings guilt. What shall we do with the guilt of our sin? Well, we will either die in it, or it shall be purged by a means outside of ourselves. We will either die in it, or God will count our sin toward another who will die in our guilt in our place. And I think what the trajectory in Deuteronomy is pointing to is ultimately the purging of sin from God's creatures and creation through the finished work of Christ on the cross, where you see Jesus, not a heifer with a broken neck. But instead, that animal, like all the animals in sacrificial ceremonial procedures, have shadows in the new covenant made full and lit up by the cross and resurrection of Jesus. Jesus is the one to bring atonement. So the instincts of these people are right. Lord, sin has taken place. It has brought defilement. It has brought guilt. All of that is true. All of that operates on the moral sphere of what we can observe in continuity with the Deuteronomy 21 passage and our present day. Sin brings defilement. Sin brings guilt. What are you going to do with that? It needs to be purged because those who wrong God's law deserve to be judged according to the law. And if we were to be judged according to the law, who should stand? We should be rightly condemned. And what these ceremonies, which are no longer brought in continuity into the new covenant, what they act as are shadows or types pointing forward to the work of Christ. John Gill was an English Baptist pastor and theologian in the 1700s. And he wrote this about Deuteronomy 21. Gill says, "In this was a type of Christ, who was put to death at the instigation of the elders of the Jewish nation." So he's drawing a parallel here that here you have Israelite elders in the Old Testament who are to put the innocent to death. And that's because the day would come when Israelite elders would put the innocent one to death. The righteous and holy one, the one who is not simply not bearing the yoke or, you know, in some way unworked, but instead one who without moral defect and without sin was put forward in our place. So we think about Deuteronomy 21 and we see, well, sin is not nothing, is it? Sin is serious. Sin not only impacts the individual sinned against, like this man whose life was taken, a violation of the sixth commandment. Even communities and neighbors are affected by rebellion against the law of God. What shall we do with all this sin? And the answer is not breaking the neck of another heifer. The answer is going to Jesus. The answer is crying out to Christ. The answer is believing the good news. The answer is seeing in the light where all of the covenant shadows in the Old Testament were pointing. And these elders were washing their hands because they knew they were innocent. You know, Pilate thought that too. If you go to Matthew 27, verse 24, it says, when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, because you see, he's convinced Jesus isn't guilty of what they're charging him with. He's investigated this, even sent him to Herod Antipas, who drew the same conclusion. This man is innocent. This man is innocent. And Pilate, seeing he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, Matthew tells us he took water, and he washed his hands before the crowd, and he said, "I am innocent of this man's blood." Well, not so fast. That's a complicated situation. Because Pilate knows he's condemning an innocent man. And to condemn an innocent man to death is a violation of the law of God. Pilate can imagine, "Oh, I washed my hands of this man's blood." That is not like the innocents in Deuteronomy 21. This is not like the Valley of Running Water, where they were actually innocent of the... Pilate is guilty of the man's blood. He knowingly sent forth Christ into their riotous, crucifixion-demanding hands. And the Romans put Jesus to death. But this principle of seeing something that is innocent, taking the place of what is guilty, and being put to death to deal with sin, guilt, and defilement, has the good news of the gospel all over it, right there in the Old Testament. Let's pray.